intercontinental. Their reaction time had been excellent, which pissed me off even more. If it wasn't for them being on heightened alert because of the EU conference, they'd have taken a lot longer to get their act together. I moved towards the car park entrance. The streetlights illuminated the edge of the compound, so I could peer through the fence into the semi-darkness beyond, looking for anything unusual. Car parks are always the best place to lose a car. The downsides are that they're often monitored by video cameras, and there's a strong chance of finding some job's worth on the gate to take your cash. This one was free. No cameras, no staff, and not lit up. Which was why Sergei and I had decided to use it. The other four were using a park and ride about 7 minutes away. At the moment, however, the slightest suspicious sign, like cars with no lights but engines running, would be enough to keep me driving past. Carrying on to the junction, I turned left, crossing tram lines, and drove towards the entrance. People had stopped on the street, and shop owners were standing in their doorways looking up at the heli with its light and noise, talking excitedly to each other. I kept my eyes on the car park. It looked less than half full. Shoppers would have binned it for the day. Any vehicles that were left were probably there to stay. I indicated left, relieving Val's neck of my 88 as I needed both hands to maneuver the hillocks across the road and into a parking space. I felt exposed, waiting for a gap in the traffic, yet resisted the temptation to jump across and risk hitting an oncoming car. A gap appeared, not before time, and as I drove under a height bar, it was as if I'd entered a new world, dark and safe. Driving a circuit to check the area, I ensured that the passenger side of the hillocks would face the row of vehicles where the Volvo saloon was parked. Valentin had all but disappeared into the shadow of the footwell. The heli was quartering the night sky, raking the ground with its night sun. The dark blue Volvo saloon was nosy parked, the boot sticking out. I stopped, making a T of the car and the hillocks. The only sounds were the van's engine ticking over and the heater on full blast. Val's shoes scraped across the ribbing of the rubber matting as he shifted position. It was almost peaceful until more sirens erupted. Way over on the other side of the car park, an interior light came on as somebody got into his car. The engine didn't start up. He was probably sitting in the driver's seat, watching the heli. I waited. Now that my ears had adjusted to the new, safer environment, I could make out the metallic rumble of a tram fading towards the city centre. Police sirens wailed in the distance, as the night sun continued to scour the lake and park. The sirens got nearer. I sat, waited and watched, trying to work out where they were. Three or four police cars were following the tram lines along the fence, their flashing lights throwing bursts of colour across the roofs of the parked cars. Seconds later, two more appeared. I looked down at Val. I could make out his face in the glow of the dashboard. His eyes showed no fear. He was switched on enough to accept that overreaction at this stage could result in him being killed, or perhaps worse, seriously injured. He couldn't take that chance. From the moment he'd realized he wasn't going to die, and that capture was inevitable, he hadn't panicked. He had to assume that I would be flapping, and that any unexpected move on his part might provoke a reaction from me. And the chances were it would be a bad one. The less he resisted, the less punishment he was going to get, and the more time he'd have to watch and wait for an opportunity to escape. I pressed the release catch on the pistol grip with my right thumb and caught the magazine in my left hand as it slid from the grip, inserting a full 20-round mag in its place. I heard the click as it locked home and pulled on the bottom to check it was going to stay put. I put the half-empty mag in my right pocket along with the taped sockets. I didn't want to risk slapping a half-empty one back in if I was in the shit and had to change mags in a hurry. Another three or four police cars crossed the entrance, lights flashing and sirens blasting. The night sun was now roaming around in quick, jerky movements. The heli watcher in the car park had seen enough and drove out towards the main. The warning buzzer sounded as I took the keys out of the ignition. My lights were still on. I looked down at Val.
Stay.
I sounded as if I was talking to a dog. I got out of the hillux and could hear the thud, thud, thud of the heli's rotor blades as it hovered in the distance. All their attention was still in the immediate vicinity of the hotel. But I knew it wouldn't last. The cold air scoured my face as I walked around the front of the wagon, cutting through the headlights, keeping my eyes on the cab, the weapon down by my side. More flashing lights and sirens headed up the main. This time, some of the squad cars started to peel off. One came down the road I'd made my approach on. Brilliant blue strobes bouncing off me and the vehicles around me for a few seconds as it passed. My attention was focused on the main entrance. Would the next set of lights come into the car park? I knew there was nothing I could do about it but watch and wait. But that didn't stop my heart rate shifting up a gear or two. Seconds later, the darkness returned. Only the sirens were left dying in the distance. The heli noise throbbed back into earshot. I felt under the rear right-hand wheel arch of the Volvo with my fingers and retrieved the magnetic box that held the key. I hit the fob, and there was a comforting whoop as the doors unlocked. I inserted the key in the boot lock and pulled it open. Reggie and Ronnie had glued thick sponge all round the framework of the luggage area, mainly so the target didn't injure himself, but also to subdue any noise if he felt like having a kick and scream while we were in transit. As an extra precaution, the light units had been taped down on the inside. The last thing we needed was for Val to pull one off, stick his hand through as we waited at a set of lights and waved to a family on their way to give Granny her Christmas presents. They'd also lined the floor with a thick Four Seasons duvet, with another on top, ready to stop him dying of hypothermia. Sitting on top was an orange plastic ball about the size of an egg, a roll of black gaffer tape, and several sets of plastic cuffs. I opened the passenger door and Val looked up at me, then across at the boot and its contents. I didn't have a clue what would happen to him once we hit St. Petersburg, and I didn't care. All I was concerned about was the $500,000 on offer, or what was left of it after Sergei got his $200,000. Scanning the area once more, I brought the .88 up, angled my wrist at 90 degrees and rammed the weapon into the space above his bulletproof waistcoat, then yanked it back into its normal position so the muzzle was twisted in his shirt. I didn't need to force his head downwards. He wanted to see what was happening as I placed my right index finger back on the trigger. Tilting the weapon up so the grip was near his face, I made sure he saw me remove the safety catch with my thumb and heard the click. I didn't need to explain the fact of life to him. After all, he hadn't got where he was today by helping old ladies across the road. As far as Val was concerned, this was just another day in paradise. It wasn't about to fuck about now. With my free hand, I reached under his waistcoat. Up, up, up! There was no argument. His knees came out of the footwell, and he staggered onto the tarmac. I turned him round so the backs of his thighs were against the boot of the Volvo and leaned forward onto him as more sirens wailed in the distance and the heli fought to keep position against the wind. He got the idea and manoeuvred himself in, keeping his eyes fixed on mine. Still no fear in them, though. The look was more analytical now, as if he was conducting some sort of character assessment, trying to figure me out. He was in total control of himself. It was not the reaction you'd expect from the victim of a lift, and I found it unnerving. He ended up on his back in the boot, knees up and hands across his stomach. Swapping over hands on the .88, I got hold of the orange plastic ball and stuffed it into his mouth. Still, there was no resistance. Just some snorting through his nose as I rammed the ball home. Reggie and Ronnie had folded over the last 4 inches of the roll on the gaffer tape so I could do the next bit with just one hand. I taped round his mouth and chin, then carried on up around his ears and eyes, leaving just his nose uncovered. More sirens and lights, this time moving along the side road, the same way I had come. It wouldn't be long now before they started to check the car parks. I heard the heli's engine change pitch. It was moving again, its night sun now at 45 degrees, illuminating everything in its path, working its way towards me. Slamming the boot shut on Val, I jumped back into the hillocks as the noise increased and the beam got brighter. There is no hiding place from those beams once they ping you. If they did, I'd change my mind about the $500,000 and just make a run for it on foot. I had my escape route worked out, straight over the fence and into the maze of apartment blocks opposite. I sat and waited. There was nothing else I could do. The car and van took a direct hit, and it felt like a scene from Close Encounters as both vehicles were flooded with light. A second or two later, the engine note changed, and the heli lurched in the direction of the main route out of town. The shadows returned as it moved away across the sky. I drove the van into an empty space, got out, and went to check on Val. He was breathing heavily. I watched him and waited. He might have sinus problems, a blocked nose, the flu. I didn't want him to die. I only got paid for meat on the hoof. He snorted loudly to clear his nose. Headlights veered towards me, but I hadn't heard a car door slam. It wasn't somebody from the car park. I leaned over Val to make it look as if I was sorting out my packages. Our faces were close to one another, and I felt his breathing against my cheek. It was the first time I'd actually smelled him. After my little stay with Carpenter and Nightmare, I was expecting a combination of strong cigarettes, homemade alcohol, and armpit. What I got was gaffer tape with a hint of cologne. The problem had gone. Either the vehicle had found a parking space or left the area. I didn't give a shit which. I stood up slowly and had a look around, then rammed the pistol into his neck. With my other hand, I got hold of his shoulder and started to pull. He got the drift. I wanted him on his front. The car rocked slightly with his exertions, but it didn't matter. There was nobody around to notice. Once he was on his stomach, I got hold of one of the plastic cuffs, looped it round his wrists, and pulled it tight. Then I wrapped the second duvet around him, still making sure he had room to breathe. The Volvo started first time. I headed left, out onto the main, away from the hotel. I only hoped that Sergei was doing the same. I headed east out of Helsinki, towards the motorway. The RV was at Valima, about 180 k's away. I hit the seek button on the radio and turned up the volume to drown out the noise of the heater. I drove, thinking about everything and nothing. Twice I saw the flashing lights of a heli. Eventually I passed the Valima service station area. This was trucker's heaven, the final stop before Russia. They used it as a meeting point so that they could move on in convoy. Hijacking was rife in the motherland. In amongst them, somewhere was our vehicle, with welded compartments for us all to play II's. Valima was just a few k's from Sergei's tame checkpoint. 10 k's north of the town was the lakeside house. I turned off the radio and reached into the glove compartment for the digital scanner, which Sergei had tuned into the police channel. It was about the size of a mobile phone. The plan had been to use it from the time we exited Helsinki. That was another reason I needed Sergei. He spoke Finnish. I tried to make sense of the squelchy radio traffic, but didn't have a clue what I was listening to. What I was hoping not to hear was Volvo, 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 because then it would be odds on that I had a one-way ticket to havoc. I checked every lay-by and minor gravel road for any hint of activity. There was nothing. My lights hit the marker I was looking for, mailbox 183. A red plastic pedal bin on a white pole. I turned right onto a deeply rutted track that led into the forest. It was only a few hours since we'd last driven up it. About 10 meters in, a white painted chain suspended between two poles barred the way. Attached to it was a wooden sign saying, "Fuck off, private property," in Finnish. I left the engine running and got out of the car, checking in the headlights for recent sign of another vehicle. The compacted ice was giving very little away. I looked carefully at the points where the last link of the chain was looped over a hook screwed into the right-hand pole, but could see nothing in the shadow cast by the Volvo's headlights. I took the weight of the chain so the first links came loose and pulled gently. I could feel the pressure of the cotton that still fastened it to the hook, and then the sudden pressure release as it broke. No one had been through here who shouldn't have. I drove over the chain, then jumped out and replaced it. To the side, under a pile of stones, the reel of cotton thread was just where I'd left it. I tied the first link to the hook again, replaced the reel, and got back in the car. The pines were so tall and close to the track, it was like driving through a tunnel. After 250 meters, the trees retreated, leaving a stretch of open ground about the size of 4 football pitches. I knew that in the summer it was all grass and tree stumps because there were framed pictures of it in the house. But now everything was covered by a meter-deep blanket of snow. The track dipped slightly, and the two-story house was caught in the beam of my headlights. There were no lights on inside, no vehicles outside. The track led to a wooden lean-to with enough room for 3 cars. Both buildings were made of timber and painted dark red with white window frames, and wouldn't have looked out of place in the Yukon during the gold rush. I drove into the lean-to. A huge stack of firewood filled the whole of the back wall. A door on the far left led to the other side of the house and the lake. I killed the engine, and for the first time in hours there was almost total silence. No gunfire, shouts, sirens, helis or car heaters. Just low-volume hiss and mush as Finnish police talked Finnish police stuff on the scanner. I didn't really want to move. The entrance was in the gable end of the main building, and the key was hidden in the log pile. Very original. I went inside and was hit by a wonderful warmth. The heaters worked off the mains, and we'd left them all on. The labour-intensive wood fire was for holidaymakers. Besides, chimney smoke would have advertised our presence. I threw the light switch and went back to the car for Valentin. Chapter 4. The duvet had kept him alive, but only just. After 2 hours in the boot, he was shaking with the cold. "Right, come on, up, up." I moved his legs over the sill and pulled him out by his body armour. He couldn't do much with his hands behind his back, but he seemed to be concentrating most on not having the ball fall to the back of his mouth and choke him. Fair one. That was why I'd used it. I guided him inside as his legs started to come back to life and sat him on an old green velour settee next to a radiator. The decor was functional, just bare wooden floors and walls, and the downstairs was one very large open space. A stone fireplace stood opposite the door, and 3 wooden pillars, each about 1 foot in diameter and evenly spaced, helped to support the floor above. Most of the furniture, apart from the settee, was chunky pine, and the place smelled like a timber yard. I pulled hard on the gaffer tape around Valentin's face. He winced as the adhesive took neck and eyebrow hair with it. His skin was cold, the colour of a dead cod. He spat out the ball, coughing and spluttering. I was the typical Brit abroad. When in doubt, just keep to your own language and shout. "Stay there!" I pointed at the radiator, not that he would be going anywhere plastic-cuffed up. "You'll be warm in a minute." He looked up and nodded. A gust of wind whistled under the eaves. I expected Vincent Price to turn up any minute. I went back to the car and retrieved the scanner, putting it on the kitchen table. Every 15 seconds or so there was some traffic on the net, but no detectable note of urgency, as there would be if they were sending in the helicopters. There wasn't any slow, deliberate whispering either, so hopefully they weren't trying to sneak up on me. Maybe. Who knew? The next priority was to get a brew on. The kitchen worktop stretched along the wall behind me. I went over and checked the kettle for water. Standing waiting for it to boil, I watched Bal shivering. He was sitting close enough to the heater to make it pregnant. He'd had a hard life, judging by the lines on his face. But he still had his Slavic good looks, wide cheekbones, green eyes and dark brown hair. The grey at the temples making him look pretty dignified for a hood. I had to take my hat off to him. The boy had done good. Merck's, BG, the best hotels and a great line in Slappers. I was jealous. My future was looking the same as my past. The water boiled as I opened a packet of crisp breads that was on the worktop. I munched on one and emptied the kettle onto ground beans in a cafetiere. Bal had his knees up and was trying to use his body to flick his overcoat around him. His face was starting to regain its colour and his eyes followed my every move. The team's kit had been piled into bags to the left of the main door. Sergei and I had planned to return here after delivering the money to St. Petersburg, me to drive to Sweden and then via ferry to Germany, him to clean up this place. I picked up a canvas kit bag and threw it on the table. Holstering the pistol, I fished inside for more plastic cuffs, putting three interlocking strips together to make one long one. Moving around the table, I gripped Val's shoulders, then dragged him over towards the central pillar and pushed him down on his arse against it. I plasticuffed his upper right arm to the support, then, with the leatherman, I cut the original plasticuffs so that his left arm was free. He wasn't going anywhere unless he did a Samson and took the pillar with him. Returning to the other side of the table, I pushed the plunger down on the cafetiere and filled two big mugs with steaming coffee. I threw a handful of sugar lumps into each and gave them a stir with my knife. I didn't know how he took his, but I doubted he was going to complain. I didn't normally take sugar myself, but today was an exception. I walked over to him and put his mug on the floor. He gave me a brisk nod of thanks. I couldn't tell him, but I knew what it felt like to entertain all three of Mr. and Mrs. Death's little boys, wet, cold, and hunger, and wouldn't wish them on anyone. Anyway, it was my job to keep him alive, not add to his misery. The scanner was still giving the odd burst as I settled down at the table facing Val. I took a couple of sips, and then it was time to get out of my costume. I felt uncomfortable in it, and if I had to start performing, the last thing I wanted to be wearing was a suit and a pair of lace-up shoes. Lugging my diving bag over to the table, I dug out jeans, Timberland boots, T-shirt, sweatshirt, and a green Helly Hansen fleece. The Chechen watched me intently as he drank coffee and I got changed. I got the sense he was enjoying my failure to interpret the scanner traffic. I felt much more my old self as I tucked my weapon into the front of my jeans. I went back to my coffee. Valentin had finished his, and the empty mug was at his feet. I took him the cafetiere and a packet of crisp breads. He nodded as I poured new brews for both of us. I sat at the table and ate the last of the bananas Reggie and Ronnie had left behind. The scanner continued to crackle away, and in the silences between bursts from the operating stations, all I could hear was the crunching of crisp bread. I couldn't stop thinking about Sergei. What if he didn't turn up? I hadn't worked that one out yet. I hadn't even wanted him to come on the lift. It would have been better if he'd just stayed with the truck. We'd all have RV'd with him, then been chauffeured across the border, but he insisted on being there in case there was any dodgy dealing. I would probably have done the same myself. But now what? I had another thought. What would happen if one of Sergei's boys was still alive? It probably wouldn't take too long for the police to get him to talk. I stopped munching and put down my mug. Shit. We had to get out of here. Getting to my feet, I grabbed Carpenter's and Nightmare's bags and took a red ski jacket and bottoms from mine. I put the .88 and the mags in the front pockets and threw Carpenter's cold weather gear to Val. Carpenter was a big boy, so the fit wasn't going to be a problem. Leaving him to figure out how he was going to put it on with his arm still secured, I ran upstairs to get two double duvets. Once back downstairs, I pulled my weapon, cut him free, and stepped back. "Get dressed!" I shouted, miming putting on a jacket. He got the hint and started removing his overcoat and tuxedo. I watched him, ready to react to any wrong move. Everything he was wearing stank of money. His shoes were so smart, I looked at the label. English, Patrick Cox. A few pairs of those would have paid for my roof repair. I let him keep his wallet, having checked through it and seen old pictures of children dressed in romper suits. I'd always avoided getting lumbered with stuff like that myself, but understood that these things were important to people. Val was soon dressed in a pair of yellow salopettes, a green ski jacket, an orange bubble hat with big dangling pom-poms, gloves, a scarf, and a pair of cold weather boots, all of which must have been at least three sizes too big. He looked ready for a stint as a children's entertainer. I pointed the pistol up and back towards the pillar. He went over obediently. I showed him that I wanted him to hug it, an arm either side. Then it was just a matter of making up another set of extra-long plastic cuffs, doing up two ratchets so it was like a lasso, looping it over his wrists and pulling tight. I left him to adjust himself as I took my torch and went outside into the lean-to for a couple of shovels, one a big trough-type one, used for clearing pathways of snow, the other a normal building site job. I dumped them on the table and the torch went into my salopette pocket. Val was trying to work out what I was up to. He was looking at me in the same way as his slapper had done in the hotel, as if there was no danger and nothing was happening that might affect him. He appeared to think he was just a neutral observer. I started ransacking the cupboards, looking for thermos flasks and food. I was out of luck. It looked as if we'd both had our last hot drink and crisp bread for a while. I picked up my mug and down the last of the coffee as I walked over to him. I put his mug in his hand and indicated that he should do the same. He was soon busy manoeuvring his head around the post to meet his hands, while I took candles and matches from the cupboard under the sink and threw them into one of the bags. Once I'd stuffed the duvets on top and done up the zip, I cut him free, motioning him to put the bag on his back. He knew what I meant, and used the two handles as if they were straps on a Bergen. I put on my black woolen hat and ski gloves, then picked up the shovels from the table and used them to guide him out of the door. I walked behind, hitting the light switch. I left the scanner on the table. It would give our position away to use it out there. I held him as I got the keys from the Volvo. It was my only transport out of here and I wanted to make sure it stayed that way. Once through the lean-to door, we followed the well-worn track in the snow towards the lake shore. It was pitch black out here, and bitterly cold. The wind was much stronger now. Swirling snow stung my cheeks as we moved forwards. The helis wouldn't be up around here in this wind. Chapter 5. A small wooden hut housing the wood-burning sauna stood about 30 meters away along the frozen lake shore. Beyond it was a wooden jetty, which stood about a meter above the ice. The Chechen was still ahead of me, leaning into the wind and half-turning from the waist to protect his face from the driving snow. He stopped when he got to the sauna, perhaps expecting me to motion him inside. Instead, I sent him round to the right. He obediently stepped out a meter or so along the jetty. "Whoa! Stop there!" I shouted. "Stop! Stop! Stop!" He turned round, and I pointed with my pistol down at the frozen lake. He looked at me quizzically. "Down there, on the ice, on the ice." Very slowly, he got down and sat in the snow, then rolled over, tentatively prodding the ice to make sure it would take his weight. I knew it would. I'd been messing about on it for the last 2 weeks. Once he was standing, I got him to move out of reach while I clambered down, in case he decided he'd had enough of this game and wanted to play stealing cars and driving home. Prodding him along the ice with the shovels, I paralleled the lake shore. By taking this route, we wouldn't leave any sign from the house, but it meant we were more exposed to the wind. It was just a matter of leaning into it until we'd covered 150 meters to the tree line. Once there, we carried on for a bit before I gave him another shout. He turned again, awaiting new instructions. His head tilted against the wind, screaming across the lake. I could hear his labored breathing and just make out the shape of his face as I pointed at the trees to our right. He turned towards them and started to move as the wind buffeted the backs of our jackets. The snow was no problem at first, no more than about 2 feet deep, but soon it was up to our waists. He did all the work, ploughing through it. I just followed in his wake as his boots crunched down until they met compacted surface. Lifted up and did the same thing all over again. We moved another 50 meters. About 10 meters inside the tree line, and that was enough. We were in direct line of sight of the house. Having spent my childhood in South London housing estates, to me the countryside had always been just a green place full of animals that hadn't yet been frozen or cooked. I hadn't been into all the trapping stuff I was taught while in the regiment. In fact, I'd forgotten most of it. I'd never felt the need to run around in a hat made out of freshly skinned rabbit. Building shelters, however, was a skill I did keep tucked away somewhere in the back of my head. I vaguely remembered that there would be spaces beneath the spreading boughs of the conifers at snow level. Finding what seemed the biggest tree in the forest, I rammed the large shovel into the snow just short of where the lowest branches disappeared. Moving back out of the way so he couldn't hit me with it, I motioned for Val to take off the bag. No problem from him on that one. Then I gave him the other spade. Val didn't need any further encouragement. The wind was blowing hard, flattening my jacket against my body, and if we were to stay alive out here, we had to get out of it soon. The ambient temperature was low enough as it was, but the effect of wind chill took it well below freezing. He might have been wearing a dinner jacket earlier on and heading for a night at the theatre, but he was obviously no stranger to physical graft. You can always tell whether someone's used to a shovel. He worked efficiently, not tearing the arse out of it, obviously knowing better than to let himself break out in a sweat and have it freeze on him later. After a while, he stopped digging, got on his knees, and started to scoop out snow with his gloved hands. Then he disappeared into the cave. A few minutes later, he turned and stuck his head out. I thought I could just about make out a hint of a proud smile from under his hat. I waved him back inside, throwing the bag in with him. Before I joined him, I pulled back the index finger of my right-hand glove, pushing my trigger finger through the slit. I'd prepared this one just like the leather pair for the build-up. I followed him head-first, with the 88 up, hitting the torch button once in cover. The shelter could have taken 3 people kneeling. Once in, I slid round and landed up on my arse with a pistol in the aim. I put the torch in my mouth. For him, it was bondage time again. Pulling a set of plastic cuffs from my pocket, I stuck the pistol into his neck, twisting it into his skin this time. I plastic cuffed his left hand at the branch above him. Snow fell on us as I ratcheted the plastic tight. We both shook our heads, trying to get it off our faces. With his arm now strapped above his head, Val sat there looking like a gibbon as I got out a candle and matches. The candle provided more light than it would normally have, thanks to the reflection from the brilliant white walls. I crawled back to the entry point, pulled in the shovels, and used one to pile snow across the gap. It would keep out the wind. It was time to get everything else sorted. I emptied the contents of the bag and started to spread out the duvets on the ground. Contact with the snow would conduct heat away from our bodies about 20 times faster than if we sat on the bedding. Next, I smoothed out the sides of our hull with a gloved hand so that, as heat rose, the melting snow didn't form drip points and fall on us like rain. That done, I dug a small channel around the edge, so that whatever did start to melt would run down the sides and refreeze there. In situations like this, 5% extra effort always leads to 50% more comfort. The wind was no longer the prominent noise. The rustling of nylon clothing and both of us sniffing or coughing had taken over. The cave was beginning to look like a steam room as our breath hung in clouds in a confined space. Using the grip end of a shovel, I dug a small tunnel. I needed to be able to see out towards the house, and we needed ventilation. The candlelight wouldn't be seen directly from the house, as it was low down and in an alcove. I just had to hope the ambient glow wasn't bright enough to be seen either, because there was no way we could do without it. Even the small amount of heat from a candle flame can help bring the temperature up to freezing point. On my knees, I looked towards the house. Well, it was out there in the darkness somewhere. Even with this amount of clothing on and some insulation beneath me, my body was still cold because we weren't moving. I readjusted my position so that I was comfortable and could still see outside. Val continued to study me. At least 2 very cold, boring hours must have passed with me listening to the wind and Val constantly fidgeting to get feeling back into his arm, when all of a sudden he said, "The Malaskaya must have offered you quite a sizable amount of money to keep me alive. I am obviously more of a threat to them than I thought." I spun round in amazement. It was a very confident, clear voice. He was smiling. He obviously liked my reaction. "Now that you are alone, I should imagine it will be quite difficult to get me out of the country. To wherever it is the Malaskaya want you to take me." He paused. "St. Petersburg, perhaps." I stayed silent. He was right. I was in the shit. "You have a name, I presume." I shrugged. "It's Nick."
"Ah, Nicholas. You're British."
"Yeah, that's right." I turned back to the house.
"Tell me, Nicholas, what did the Malaskaya offer you? 1 million US? Let me tell you, I am worth considerably more than that to them. What is 1 million? It wouldn't even buy a decent apartment in London. I know. I have 3.
I carried on looking out of the hole. "I don't know who or what the Malaskaya are. They sound Russian, but I was employed in London." He laughed.
"London, New York, it doesn't matter. It was them. They would very much like to have a meeting with me."
"Who are they?"
"The same as me, but infinitely more dangerous, I can assure you."
He got up onto his knees, and a small shower of ice fell as the branch moved. I couldn't imagine anyone being more dangerous. Russian Organizatsiya, ROC, were spreading their operations around the world, growing faster than any crime organization in the history of mankind. From prostitution to blackmail, bombing hotels to buying Russian Navy submarines to smuggle drugs, all the different gangs and splinter groups were infiltrating nearly every country to the tune of billions of dollars. These people were making so much money, it made Gates and Branson look like welfare cases. With that much money and power at stake, I was sure there would be the odd disagreement between different groups. There was silence for a while as I kept a trigger on the house. Then Val spoke again.
"Nick, I have a proposition that I think will appeal to you."
Chapter 6. I didn't respond, just kept my eyes on the house.
"It's a very simple proposition. Release me, and I will reward you handsomely. I have no idea what your plan is now. Mine, however, is to stay alive and at liberty. I am willing to pay you for that.
I turned to look at him. How? There's nothing in your wallet but photographs. He tutted, a father addressing a wayward son.
Nick, correct me if I'm wrong. But now that your plan has failed, I imagine you would like to get away from this country as quickly as you can. Release me. Return to London, and then I will get you the money. One of my apartments is in the name of Mr. P. P. Smith.
He smiled. The name seemed to amuse him.
The address is 3A, Palace Gardens, Kensington. Would you like me to repeat that?
No, I've got it. I knew the area. It fitted the bill. It was full of Russians and Arabs. People with so much money they owned apartments worth millions and only used them once in a blue moon.
Let's say that in 2 days' time, and for the next 7 days after that, from noon till 4 p.m., there will be somebody at that address. Go there, and you will receive $100,000, U.S.
A drop of melted ice hit me on the cheek. I took a handful of snow from the tunnel and ran it over the drip point, my mood as black as the night I was staring into. What the fuck was I doing freezing in this snow hole? I had $500,000 sitting here with me, from doing something the firm would have paid me a couple of hundred a day for. But I couldn't get at it. My only hope of ever seeing it was Sergei. I fuck knew where he was. Val knew when to talk and when to shut up and let people think. I went back to watching the house for another hour or so, getting even more cold and miserable. I was slowly convincing myself that if Sergei didn't make an appearance, I should take my chances with Val in London. Why not? It wasn't as if I had anything to lose, and I was desperate for the paycheck. I could only hear the faint noise of the engine at first. It was tucked into the trees somewhere on the track and fighting to be heard above the wind. Then headlights appeared out of the tree line, heading towards the house. The noise got louder as it moved along the track. It was a 4x4 in low ratio. Sergei? It was impossible to tell if it was the Nissan from this distance. Val had also heard it and was keeping still so his jacket didn't rustle and drown out the noise. I watched the headlights briefly illuminate the front of the house before turning into the lean-to and cutting out. I heard just one door slam and my eyes moved to the windows. I saw nothing. I slid over to Val. Passively, he let me check his plastic cuffs. They were secure. He wasn't going anywhere unless he happened to have a chainsaw hidden inside his coat. All the same, I wished I'd brought some tape to cover his mouth in case he decided to shout for help. It wasn't until I blew out the candle so he couldn't use it to burn the cuffs off and started to push my way out of the snow that he sparked up. Nick? I stopped, but didn't turn. What?
Think about what I have said as you go to meet your friends. My offer is infinitely more profitable for you, and, may I say, safer.
We'll see. I pushed myself out into the wind and was very much thinking about it, glad that Val wasn't going to scream and shout out. He knew what was happening. If it was Sergei at the house, Val could shove his offer. By the morning we would be in St. Petersburg, and I'd have my money and be on my way back to London. As I retraced my route, the wind was blowing head-on, making my eyes stream. I could feel my tears turn to ice. I listened to the trees creak in the gale. Snow, whipped into a frenzy, attacked the exposed skin around my neck and face as I tried to focus on the house and surrounding area. Kicking on about 20 meters, I checked the house again. The upstairs lights were on now, but there was still no movement inside. Moving off once more, I tried not to get too euphoric about the prospect of Sergei being there, but the feeling that this job could soon be over made the wind seem marginally less powerful. Once, below the sauna, on the lake, I pulled my trigger finger from its glove and pulled out the .88. It was far too dark to see with the naked eye, so I checked the chamber with my exposed finger and ensured the mag was on tight. Then climbed up onto the bank and moved forward in a semi-crouch until I got to the lean-to entrance. I was eager to make contact with Sergei, but had to take things slowly. Only when I actually saw him would I feel safe. I stood and listened at the lean-to door, not hearing anything apart from the sound of the wind bouncing it backwards against the lock. Keeping to the right of the frame, I pulled the metal handle down and the wind did the rest, forcing it inwards. Fortunately, the bottom scraped along the ground, preventing it from crashing into the woodpile. On my hands and knees in the snow, I eased my head round the bottom of the doorframe. The Nissan was parked the other side of the Volvo, the light from the ground floor window reflecting off its roof. Things were looking up. But I'd have to wait a while before jumping with joy. I moved into the lean-to and checked no one was still in the Nissan. Then I pushed the door to, feeling warmer out of the wind. The entrance to the house was closed, but the warm glow from the window was enough for me to be seen if anyone came out of it. I moved to the right of the frame, pushing my ear against the door. I couldn't hear a thing. I moved to the other side of the Nissan and looked in through the window. There was no need to get right up to the glass to see in. It's always best to stay back and use the available cover. My heart sank. Carpenter. Still dressed in his suit, but now without a tie or overcoat. He was taking pills from a small tin and swallowing them, shaking his head violently to force them down. His mini Uzi was exposed, rigged up over his jacket and dangling under his right arm, with the harness strap bunching up the material where it crossed his back. He moved about the room with no apparent purpose, sometimes out of view. Then I saw he had Val's masking tape and ball gag wrapped in his massive hand. He brought them up to his face for a moment, and, realizing their significance, hurled them to the ground. Then he started lifting chairs and smashing them against the walls, kicking our overcoats about the room like a 2-year-old in a tantrum. It wasn't hard to work out what was going through his mind. He'd decided that I had left with Val for the border, leaving him in the lurch. Fair one, I'd think the same. No wonder he was chucking his toys out of the pram. The table followed the chairs as the combination of narcotics and rage started to fuck with his head. There was no reason to consider my options. He had just made up my mind for me. Moving back to the outer door, I left him to it. Checking back every 10 meters as I crossed the frozen lake, after several minutes, I saw headlights in the darkness heading away from the house and back towards the tree line. What the fuck was Carpenter up to? He probably didn't even know himself. With legs apart and slightly bent to keep myself stable in the gusts, I stood and watched until the lights disappeared into the night. It was very tempting to go back and wait in the house, but Carpenter might return and complicate matters, and anyway, there was still the police to worry about. Turning parallel to the shore, I carried on towards the snow hole. Once in the tree line, I could see the whole of the side of the house. Carpenter had left the lights on, but through the downstairs window, things didn't look right. It took me a second or two to realize what was happening. Not bothering about leaving sign, I moved as fast as I could in a direct line towards the building, stumbling over in snow that sometimes came up to my chest. I was trying so hard to get there quickly that it didn't feel as if I was making any progress. It felt like one of the recurring dreams I'd had as a kid, running to someone, but never as fast as I needed to. As I got closer, I could see flames flickering in the room, and smoke spewing out through a broken pane. A thick layer was gathering 2 or 3 feet deep on the ceiling and looking for more places to escape from. Fuck the house. It was the Volvo I was worried about. By the time I reached the lean-to, I could already hear the crackling of badly seasoned wood and the screams from the smoke alarms going apeshit. The door to the house was open. Smoke was pouring out from the top of the frame. Either Carpenter had been switched on enough to know that he had to feed the fire with oxygen, or he just didn't give a shit. It didn't matter which. The fact was that it had taken hold big time. I reached the car, the heat searing my back even through my ski jacket. The inside of the house was a furnace. As I put the key in the lock, there was a sound like shotgun rounds being fired. Spray cans of something were exploding in the heat. I reversed slowly out of the lean-to. It would have been pointless screaming out like a loony, only to get stuck in the snow. I just wanted to get clear enough so the Volvo wasn't incinerated. After a three-point turn, I drove 50 meters up the track and killed the engine. Jumping out with the keys, I stumbled back into the cover of the tree line, feeling as if I was back in that dream again. By the time I neared the hide, I could make out my shadow quite clearly against the snow. The flames were well and truly taking over from the smoke. Sliding into the snow hole, I pulled out my Leatherman, felt for the plastic cuffs, and started to cut Val free, letting him sort himself out as I scrambled out again into the wind. He soon followed, and we both stared at the burning building. Bizarrely, he started to try and comfort me.
"It's all right. I knew you weren't abandoning me. I am worth too much to you, no? Particularly now. May I suggest that we leave here, and as soon as possible. Like you, I do not want to encounter the authorities. It would be most inconvenient."
What was it with this guy? Did his pulse rate ever go above 10 beats per minute? He knew that whatever had happened out here, it had stopped me from meeting up with any of the team. He didn't have to convince me any more to let him go. He knew it was my only sensible option now. The Volvo could easily be seen in the flames. They hadn't penetrated the walls yet, but they were licking out hungrily from the windows. I stopped him short of the car, handed him my Leatherman, and carried on to open the boot, shouting at him to cut the cord in his jacket. Even at this distance, I felt the heat on my face. He looked about him, found the nylon cord that could be adjusted to tighten around his waist, and began cutting. There were loud cracks as the frame of the house was attacked by the flames. Val looked at the fire as he heard the boot open.
"Please, Nick, this time inside the car. It's very cold in there."
It was a request rather than a demand.
"And of course, I'd prefer your company to that of the spare tire."
Responding to my nod, he settled in the Volvo's rear footwell, giving me back the Leatherman and offering his hands. I tied them around the base of the handbrake with the cord where I could see them. We drove out, leaving the fire to do what it had to do. Maybe it wasn't such a bad thing. At least there wouldn't be any evidence of me ever having been there. There was no sign of Carpenter or anyone else as we bumped our way up to the chain gate. I left it on the ground where I found it, as a warning to Sergei. There was still a chance that he'd got away. There'd been two hillocks in the hotel car park. Maybe he'd nicked the other one. It was too late now to hope that he might get us over the border, but I still didn't want him to get caught. He was a good guy, but fuck it. I was on a new phase now, and one that had nothing to do with any of them. I had lost. I had to accept it. Now I had to take my chances with Val. "I'll drop you off at a train station," I said as we headed towards Valimar. "You sort yourself out from there."
"Of course. My people will extricate me quite swiftly."
There was no emotion in his voice. He sounded like a Russian version of Jeeves.
"May I give you some advice?"
"Why not?"
My eyes were fixed on the road, heading for the motorway past the town, seeing nothing but piled up snow on either side of me. The wind buffeted the side of the car enough for me to have to keep adjusting the steering. It was like having a heavy Arctic drive past on a motorway.
You will obviously want to leave the country quickly, Nick. May I suggest Estonia? From there, you can get a flight to Europe fairly easily, or even a ferry to Germany. After what has happened at the hotel, only a fool would try to leave Helsinki by air, or cross into Sweden.
I didn't reply, just stared at the snow in the headlights. Just over 2 hours later, we were approaching Puistola, one of the Helsinki suburbs. Not that I could see any of it. First lights wasn't for another 4 hours. People would soon be waking up to their cheese and meatballs and listening to the radio accounts of last night's gunfight at the OK Corral. I looked for signs to the train station. The morning rush hour, if there was one, would start in an hour or two. Pulling into the car park, I cut him free of the handbrake. He knew to stay still and wait for me to tell him when to move. He was so close to freedom, why jeopardize things now? I got out and stood away from the car, my pistol in the pocket of my puffer jacket. He crawled out, and we both stood in a line of frozen-over cars, in the dark, as he sorted himself out, tucking in his clothes and running his hands through his hair. Still looking ridiculous in carpenter's salopettes and ski jacket, he clapped his gloved hands together to get some circulation going, eventually extending one of them to me. The only shaking I did was with my head. He understood why and nodded.
Nick, thank you. You will receive your reward for releasing me. P.P. Smith. Remember the rest?
Of course I did. My eyes were fixed on his. I considered telling him that if he was lying to me, I'd find him and kill him. But it would have been a bit like telling Genghis Khan to watch himself. He smiled. He'd read my mind again.
Don't worry. You will see that I am a man of my word.
He turned and walked towards the station. I watched him crunch along in the snow, breath trailing behind.